At Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're the place you come to get the core insights from essential sources, all boiled down.
That's right. And today we're tackling someone really quite formidable. Arthur Schopenhauer.
Yeah, Schopenhauer. If you've heard the name, you probably think, ah, the misery guy. Western philosophy's ultimate pessimist, right? Life is suffering. End of story.
That's definitely the reputation, the original existential grump. Why even bother, some might say.
Exactly. But here's the twist we're exploring today, and we're using Christopher Janaway's fantastic book, Schopenhauer, Will, Suffering, and Liberation as our guide.
Mm-hmm.
Janaway makes a really strong case that just dismissing Schopenhauer as a downer is, well, missing the point. Mm-hmm. His philosophy, while it looks dark on the surface.
It's actually one of the most coherent and, frankly, compelling accounts of what it means to be human. It offers some genuine, if maybe tough, wisdom about living. Yeah, wisdom about finding some kind of peace, even. Janaway presents it as this realistic, maybe even brutally honest, but ultimately liberating view.
That's the core argument, yes. So our mission today in this deep dive is to really unpack the system Janaway lays out. We'll look at Schopenhauer's big ideas, the will, this all-consuming force.
Suffering, which seems unavoidable.
And crucially, the paths he saw towards, well, liberation, real peace.
Okay, but before we jump into the deep end of metaphysics, let's talk about our guide here, Christopher Janaway. Who is he? And why is his take on Schopenhauer considered so valuable?
Right, good question. Janaway is a very distinguished professor of philosophy currently at the University of Southampton. He's internationally known as a top expert on both Schopenhauer and, interestingly, Nietzsche, too.
Okay, so he's got the credentials. What makes his approach special, though?
Well, a few things. First, he works directly with the original German texts. That means serious scholarly rigor, not just relying on, you know, translations or secondary summaries.
That's important, getting back to the source.
Definitely. And second, he manages to blend that analytical clarity, the kind often prized in, say, Anglo-American philosophy, with a deep understanding of the historical context, which is crucial for these German thinkers.
So he bridges different philosophical styles.
He does. And maybe most importantly, Janaway treats Schopenhauer not as some dusty historical figure, but as a living philosopher, someone whose ideas about consciousness, about ethics, about why we suffer, are incredibly relevant right now.
Like he's still part of the conversation today.
Exactly. He shows how Schopenhauer anticipated ideas we see later in psychology, like with Freud, or even in modern thinking about the mind.
Okay, so let's dive into the book itself. Janaway's goal is to show Schopenhauer's system as this unified whole, right? Moving past just pessimist. What's the absolute bedrock of this system?
It all hinges on this really radical split, a fundamental division in how we understand reality. Schopenhauer called it a bifurcation. He said the world exists in two basic ways.
Two ways, okay.
First, there's the world as representation. This is the world we see, touch, interact with, the world structured by our minds, things like space, time, cause, and effect. It's the surface level.
So like the chairs we're sitting on, the sounds we hear, that's all representation. It's how our mind processes things, kind of like the Hindu idea of Maya, the veil of illusion.
Precisely like Maya, yes.
Okay.
He uses that comparison himself. It's the phenomenal world, the world as it appears to us. But that's only one side of the coin.
Okay, so what's the other side? What's behind the veil?
That's the world as will. This is the ultimate reality. It's described as a single, undifferentiated, blind, irrational force. It's constantly striving, constantly pushing.
Whoa, okay. A single force driving what?
Everything. Absolutely everything. From gravity pulling planets to plants growing towards the sun to, well, every desire you feel, every impulse. It's the raw fundamental energy of existence itself.
And it's irrational, not guided by reason.
Completely irrational. Blind striving. No goal, no purpose. Just endless wanting. And that's where the suffering inevitably comes in, according to Schopenhauer.
Right. I can see that now. If the fundamental reality is just endless, blind wanting, and we are part of that reality,
then we are fundamentally creatures of want, of striving. And since the will, by its very nature, can never be permanently satisfied because it has no ultimate goal, life is inherently marked by suffering.
So the suffering isn't just like bad luck or poor circumstances. It's baked into the system.
It's baked in. Janaway really drives this home. Schopenhauer isn't just being gloomy. He's offering a metaphysical diagnosis. This is why life feels the way it does.
Okay, wow. That is a lot. But you said Janaway highlights paths out of this? Or at least ways to deal with it.
Yes, thankfully. Schopenhauer doesn't just leave us stuck. He outlines ways to find some peace, some transcendence.
What are they?
Well, there are sort of levels. There's temporary relief, which comes through things like aesthetic contemplation, appreciating art, music, beauty.
Okay, a temporary fix.
Then there's a more profound ethical path, grounded in compassion for others.
Compassion. Interesting.
And finally, the most radical path, the ultimate solution, what he calls the denial of the will, an ascetic turning away from life's striving.
Denial of the will. Okay, we definitely need to unpack that. But first, how did he even arrive at this idea of the will? You mentioned Kant earlier. Didn't Kant say the thing in itself, ultimate reality, was unknowable?
He did. That's the standard Kantian view. Kant basically said, look, our minds structure experience using categories like space, time, causality. We can know the phenomenal world, the world of appearances, but the noumenal world, the reality behind appearances, the thing in itself, that's forever beyond our grasp.
We're stuck on the island of experience, as you said.
Right. But here's Schopenhauer's big innovative move, and Janaway explains it really clearly. Schopenhauer agreed we can't know the thing in itself objectively from the outside as representation.
Okay.
But, he argued, we have one unique point of access, one place where we experience reality not just as representation, but directly from the inside.
And where's that?
Our own bodies. Specifically, our experience of willing.
So when I feel that urge, that desire, when I decide to move my arm, that's me experiencing the will directly.
That's exactly his argument. Your body, experienced from within, isn't just an object in space representation. It is an act of will. You feel the striving, the impulse, the desire immediately.
So the force I feel inside me
is a direct manifestation of that same fundamental, irrational, striving will that underlies the entire universe. That's the key. We have this one little window into the noumenal realm.
Wow. Okay, that's a huge leap from Kant. So this will is the single driving force. Representation is the surface. And this dynamic inevitably leads to suffering.
Because the will is never satisfied. It's just endless cycles of desire. You want something, maybe you get it, then what?
And you want something else, or you get bored.
Exactly. Boredom is key here. Janaway emphasizes how Schopenhauer saw boredom not just as emptiness, but as a positive form of suffering. It's the pain of the will having no immediate object to latch onto, that restless grinding energy with nowhere to go.
So it's not just pain or boredom, it's pain then boredom, then back to pain.
Life swings like a pendulum, backward and forward, between pain and boredom. That's one of his most famous lines. The cycle seems inescapable.
And making it all worse, you mentioned earlier, is this idea of individuality being an illusion, the principium individuationis.
Right. That's Latin for the principle of individuation. Basically, the idea that space and time, part of representation, create the illusion that we are all separate, distinct individuals.
But underneath, we're all just expressions of the same single will.
Precisely. Think of it like waves on the ocean. Each wave seems separate, individual for a moment, but they're all just movements of the one underlying body of water, the will.
And believing we're separate, that causes problems.
Huge problems. It's the root of egoism, selfishness, conflict. We strive for our satisfaction against others because we don't realize that their suffering, their striving, is ultimately rooted in the same will that animates us. Harming them is, in a metaphysical sense, harming ourselves.
Okay, this is making sense, albeit quite starkly. So how do we get even temporary relief from this relentless cycle? You mentioned art.
Yes, aesthetics. For Schopenhauer, art offers a precious, though temporary, escape. When we engage in genuine aesthetic contemplation, really looking at a painting or getting lost in a piece of music, something shifts.
What shifts?
We momentarily stop seeing the world through the lens of our own desires, our own needs, our own will. We're not asking, what can this do for me? Or how does this relate to my goals?
We just observe, appreciate.
Exactly. We become what he called a willless subject of knowing. We apprehend the object, the artwork, the landscape, not as a particular thing serving our interests, but as representing a universal, timeless, Platonic idea.
Platonic ideas, like the perfect form of treeness or beauty.
Sort of, yes. These universal essences behind the particular things, and in contemplating them, our own personal striving just fades away for a moment. We get a brief taste of peace.
And music is special in this.
Music is the highest art for Schopenhauer. Because unlike painting or sculpture, which represent the ideas indirectly through objects, music, he argued, bypasses the ideas altogether.
It bypasses them. How?
He thought music was a direct copy or representation of the will itself, its rhythms, melodies, harmonies. They articulate the very essence of striving, suffering, joy, and peace. that characterizes the will.
Wow. That's why music can feel so primal, so direct. It speaks straight to that underlying force in us.
That was his explanation. Hmm. It doesn't need concepts or images. It resonates directly with the will, hence its unique power to move us so profoundly.
Okay, so art gives us moments of peace. What about more lasting change? You mentioned ethics and compassion, Mitleid.
Right. This is where Schopenhauer moves towards a more sustained way of dealing with the will. His ethics aren't based on, say, divine command or rational duty like Kant's. They're grounded purely in compassion.
Mitleid. Sympathy or pity?
More than just pity. It's a deep recognition, a feeling of the shared reality of suffering. It arises when that illusion of separateness, the principium individuationis, begins to thin out. Even just a little.
So when I see someone else suffering and I feel compassion, it's because I'm implicitly recognizing what?
That their suffering isn't fundamentally different from mine. That the same underlying will that experiences pain and frustration in me is the very same will experiencing it in them.
Because we're all just waves on the same ocean.
Exactly. So true moral action, for Schopenhauer, isn't about following rules. It's about acting on this profound metaphysical insight. When you alleviate someone else's suffering, you are, in a way, alleviating the suffering of the universal will itself, the same will that constitutes your own being.
That puts a whole different spin on morality. It's not just social convention. It's tapping into the nature of reality.
It is. But even compassion, while noble, doesn't fully solve the problem because the will is still striving. Which brings us to the ultimate and most challenging path.
The denial of the will to live. This sounds intense.
It is. And Janowicz is really careful, as was Schopenhauer, to distinguish this sharply from suicide.
Okay, good. Because denial of the will to live sounds a bit like wanting to die.
Right. But suicide, Schopenhauer argued, is actually a powerful affirmation of the will. The person committing suicide isn't rejecting willing itself. They're rejecting the conditions under which they have to live. They still desperately will things to be different. They will an end to their suffering. It's a final, frustrated act of willing.
Oh, okay. So denial isn't about ending life. It's about ending willing.
Precisely. It's a fundamental shift in consciousness. Turning away from all the desires, attachments, and strivings that constitute the will to live. It's achieved through ascetic practices, detachment, renunciation, quieting the desires.
Like monks or mystics?
Very much along those lines. Think of Buddhist nirvana or Christian salvation through radical detachment. It's reaching a state of quietude, of non-striving, where the will effectively extinguishes itself within that individual. Peace through the cessation of desire.
That is a radical path indeed. Very few might achieve that.
He acknowledged it was rare, but it represented, for him, the only complete liberation from the cycle of suffering and boredom inherent in the will.
Okay, this whole system, as Janowicz presents it, is incredibly thought-provoking. Let's try to pull out some of the key themes that still resonate today. What stands out?
Well, the first, and maybe the most modern sounding, is the primacy of will over intellect. This was revolutionary. For centuries, Western philosophy mostly put reason on top.
Right, the rational mind is in charge.
Schopenhauer flips it. He says the will, our desires, drives, instincts, is primary. The intellect, our reason, is actually the servant of the will.
Ouch. So my brilliant logical arguments are just justifications for what I wanted anyway.
Uh-huh. Well, often, yes, according to Schopenhauer. Reason becomes a tool the will uses to navigate the world and get what it wants, or to rationalize its desires after the fact. This anticipates so much later psychology, like Freud's ideas about the unconscious.
It definitely forces you to be more honest about your motivations, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that ties into the second theme, the illusion of individuality. Recognizing that our sense of being a totally separate self is, in a way, constructed.
But the wave on the ocean idea again.
Right. And Janowicz shows how this isn't just metaphysics. It provides a powerful rational basis for ethics. If separateness is illusory, then harming others is, on a deep level, harming the underlying reality we all share. Compassion becomes the logical response.
Then there's the big one. Suffering is the universal condition.
Yeah, and again, Janowicz frames this not just as pessimism, but as clear-eyed diagnosis. The suffering comes from the nature of the will, endless, unsatisfiable desire.
So understanding the source helps.
It's the first step to addressing it intelligently.
Hmm.
Instead of just chasing the next desire, hoping this time it will bring lasting happiness, you understand the game is rigged. You need a different strategy.
Which leads to the fourth theme, art as temporary liberation.
Yes. It elevates art beyond mere entertainment. Aesthetic experience becomes a vital tool for psychological well-being, a way to get temporary respite from the tyranny of the will, as Janowicz puts it. It's mental restoration.
It's like giving the striving part of your brain a much-needed break.
Exactly.
Schopenhauer had such a way with words, too. Very aphoristic. Let's touch on a few of those key quotes or ideas that Janeway highlights, like the very first sentence of his main work. The world is my representation.
Boom! Right there, the core of his idealism. It means the world you experience isn't just out there objectively. It's fundamentally shaped and structured by your consciousness. There's no object without a subject perceiving it.
Everything is mediated through the mind, and then the diagnosis. All willing springs from lack, from deficiency, and thus from suffering.
That's the engine of misery right there. To want something means you lack it. Lacking it is uncomfortable. It's suffering. So willing is suffering.
Which leads directly to that pendulum quote.
Life swings like a pendulum, backward and forward, between pain and boredom. Desire is painful. Getting what you want leads only to boredom, which is its own kind of pain, which then sparks new desires. A closed loop.
Depressingly accurate sometimes. What about the music one?
Music is the direct representation of the will, that unique power we discussed. It bypasses the world of objects and speaks the language of pure striving, pure feeling.
And finally, that really tricky one about freedom. A man can do what he wants, but not want what he wants.
Ah, yes. The paradox. It means you have freedom of action. You can choose how to pursue your desires. If you want pizza, you can choose which pizza place to go to.
Okay, I'm free to act.
But Schopenhauer argues you are not free in determining what you want in the first place. Those fundamental desires for pizza, for success, for love, they well up from the irrational will, from your innate character, which is beyond your conscious control.
So I can steer the ship, but I didn't choose the destination the ship fundamentally wants to go to.
That's a pretty good analogy, yes. Our deepest wants arise from forces we don't fully command.
Okay, let's bring this down to earth a bit. How can we actually use these ideas, drawing from Janeway's interpretation? What are the real-life applications?
Well, in personal psychology, it's huge. Recognizing the primacy of the will suggests, you know, maybe relying purely on willpower isn't the best strategy for change.
Because that's just the will fighting itself.
Kind of, yeah. Instead, Schopenhauer's view encourages a more realistic approach. Maybe focus on changing your environment to make desired actions easier, or finding ways to channel or redirect existing drives rather than just trying to suppress them through sheer force of, well, will. It promotes self-awareness about what really motivates you.
That makes sense. Be smarter, not just stronger, about your own impulses. What about interpersonal ethics?
The emphasis on compassion is key. If you consciously try to recognize that the suffering you see in others comes from the same fundamental source as your own, it changes things. It can genuinely transform how you approach conflict. Instead of seeing an adversary, you might see someone else trapped in the same struggle with the will. It fosters empathy, potentially reduces judgment by highlighting that shared vulnerability. It chips away at that illusion of separateness.
And for well-being, generally.
It gives real weight to aesthetic engagement. Seriously, treating time spent with art, music, or even just appreciating nature, not as a luxury, but as a necessary practice for mental health.
Like mindful moments, but specifically aimed at quieting the will.
Exactly. Actively seeking out those will-less states of contemplation as a way to recharge, find perspective, and experience peace outside the realm of striving. It's a framework for restoration.
It really reframes things. So wrapping up our deep dive here, what was the most, maybe, surprising thing for you in revisiting Schopenhauer through Janeway's lens?
For me, it's always the unexpected sense of hope, almost, that emerges from the darkness. You start with his bleak diagnosis, life is suffering, desire is futile, but then he offers these concrete, albeit difficult, paths towards genuine peace. It's not just complaining, it's diagnosing in order to prescribe a cure. That transition from diagnosis to potential liberation is quite powerful.
Yeah, I agree. It's like the pessimism is the setup, not the punchline. For me, the biggest takeaway is how acknowledging the difficult truths, the pervasiveness of suffering, the illusion of the ego, can paradoxically be the foundation for something positive, like real compassion and maybe even wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
The whole paradigm shift he proposes is profound. Stop chasing happiness by trying to satisfy endless desires, and instead seek peace by transcending desire itself.
It's a radical reorientation, and maybe a provocative thought to leave listeners with. Schopenhauer really forces us to confront the limitations of the modern narrative, you know, the idea that more progress, more technology, more external success will inevitably equal more happiness.
He'd say we're looking in the wrong place entirely.
He'd say the problem, and therefore the solution, is fundamentally internal. It demands a kind of brutal honesty about the human condition that maybe we're not always comfortable with.
A challenging mirror, as you said, but one that might show a path towards something real.
A tough read, perhaps, but potentially transformative.
Absolutely. Powerful ideas indeed. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.